This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
All of this is connected. The growth of the fracking industry, the growth of social media, right-wing populism, and economic inequality have all been part of this recovery from the global financial crisis.
If you're someone who's curious about the geopolitical implications of carbon fuel and the ecological havoc it wreaks, you've probably come across some of Richard Heinberg's work. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with this senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, who's authored over 13 books and regularly ponders the past and future of humanity and the Earth in his Muse letter. We discuss the global debt crunch, the search for tight oil, and the concomitant acceleration of climate change. Heinberg also tells us his thoughts on negative emissions technologies and regenerative agriculture, and explains why he refers to the past 10 years as our bonus decade. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Richard Heinberg. He is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and an author of several books. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be back with you, Alex.
It's been a while since we've spoken, and really have been missing your voice in this time of trouble in many ways. You're up in Santa Rosa. We didn't speak last year while your home was being threatened by the wildfires up there, but we've had a lot of wake-up calls in Northern California. The effects of climate change are rearing their ugly head more and more frequently.
That's for sure.
Maybe we can start with negative emissions technologies. Mm-hmm. Why don't you first define them and discuss what kind of potential you see there?
Well, negative emissions technologies include anything that will get CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequestered in some form so that it doesn't go back into the atmosphere anytime soon. So that can be anything from machines that separate CO2 from the other components of air and then compress it and bury it underground, to something like planting forests that absorb CO2. Both of those are negative emissions technologies, even though from a technological standpoint, they couldn't be much different.
We often hear about CCS, carbon capture storage technologies, when it comes to coal. But CCS, when it's applied to non-fossil fuels, can be quite promising, can it?
If we think about CCS in terms of natural processes and systems within the Earth and enhancing those systems that are already capturing and storing carbon, building machines to pull carbon dioxide out of the air and store it underground, I think that's probably a non-starter, even though some of the climate scientists who produce the IPCC reports are more favorable to those technologies. Our view at Post-Carbon Institute is that they're very unlikely ever to be implemented at scale for technological and economic reasons. But on the other side, if we're talking about ways of enhancing natural means of capturing and storing carbon, there's lots of promise, and those fall into a couple of categories. One is forest, planting more forest cover, basically re-greening the planet. And the other is soil. There's a tremendous amount of carbon already in soil, and what we're doing right now with industrial agriculture is we are releasing a lot of that stored soil carbon. But we could reverse that process, and there are various ways to do that. One of those ways is with something called biochar, which is making essentially a kind of charcoal out of wood waste and other agricultural waste. And then biochar is this magical stuff that it's extremely porous, has enormous internal surface area. So it basically is like an apartment for beneficial microorganisms that are beneficial to the plants that grow in the soil. So you're making the soil more productive and more healthy, while at the same time you're storing carbon. And biochar is very stable over time. So the carbon that we put in the soil is going to stay there for many, many centuries.
And what does this mean for agriculture in terms of some of the more progressive agricultural techniques that are being practiced? Can they work hand in hand with what you're talking about?
Right. Well, any kind of permaculture or organic farming, folks in those fields are already aware of biochar. Many are already using it. It improves yields by anywhere from 10 to 30%. And biochar, or stuff that's similar to biochar, can be used for a lot of other purposes. It can be put into manufactured products and the built environment, into stuff like concrete, plastics, even cardboard and paper, to have specific uses. And when we incorporate carbon into products, it often improves the performance of those products. In other words, you'd end up with roads that would last longer, tires that would last longer, cardboard that could shield from electromagnetic radiation, just all kinds of possibilities. And the potential for sequestration of carbon in products and materials is also very large. So you add these together, regreening the environment, putting carbon back in soils, and then putting carbon into manufactured products and materials. And you do the math, and there's the potential for absorbing considerably more than the total amount of annual current emissions, carbon emissions. So we're into carbon drawdown territory. Not all of these would require a price on carbon. In other words, they don't necessarily require government policy in order to drive the market. And the reason is, first of all, improved soil fertility. That can be the biochar can be paid for through increased productivity, agricultural productivity, and then the increased performance of products and materials in many cases is profitable even without putting a price on carbon.
And these biomass systems that would be using this carbon capture and storage technology, this BECCS, it's bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. It's a fairly cumbersome abbreviation, right? But maybe you can give us some examples of how it could possibly scale.
Well, the scaling will require the participation of the industries. So we're talking about industries like the concrete industry, which right now is a huge carbon emitter. Producing cement for concrete is extremely carbon intensive, the silica and so on. So replacing a lot of that silica with carbon is going to require some major changes to the concrete industry, and it would help to have some incentives for that. In the end, we're talking about a better, longer-lived product. So there is some incentive there, but we need to get the ball rolling. If we just rely on the market to drive this shift, it's going to be too slow. So when I say that some of this can be accomplished without government participation, at the same time, we have to say, in order to get the shift to happen at speed, we are going to need government participation. So it's a tricky situation. On one hand, we're looking at the possibility of improved performance, better materials and processes, but on the other hand, that's a transformation that if it's going to happen fast enough to make a difference in terms of the climate to keep us below 2 degrees Celsius warming, we're going to need some incentives and some system-wide drivers to make the shift happen.
Though you've played with love and loss, the sorrows have turned your heart to frost, I will melt your heart again. Remember the feeling as a child when you woke up in the morning smile. It's time, it's time, it's time, you felt like that again. There is just no percentage in remembering the past. It's time you learn to live again in love and laugh. Come with me, leave your yesterday behind, and take a giant step outside your mind.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He is a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and an author. So, Richard, I wanted to discuss a newsletter posting that you had put out in October of 2018. You call it your Muse Letter, and it's entitled Our Bonus Decade. And that kind of looked at the last decade, 2008 to 2018, recovering from the financial crash and how that all kind of fits in with the shale gas boom, which has kind of put peak oil on the back burner for about a decade. Maybe you can give us a quick review of how that all fits in with your general outlook on how oil markets and financial markets intersect.
Well, back in 2008, we were seeing world oil production starting to flatline. Actually, it began to flatline around 2005, and by 2008, world oil prices were being bid up to about $150 a barrel. That was in July 2008, and within a couple of months after that, we had the global financial crisis. The financial industry crashed, Lehman went back bankrupt, and so on and so on. Everybody knows that story. But what happened immediately after that was something that a lot of us did not anticipate. Instead of oil prices just rising and rising, and the economy crashing and crashing, what we got instead was a frenzy of drilling and fracking in tight reservoirs in the U.S., mostly in North Dakota and South Texas, producing stuff that folks in the industry call light tight oil. It's tight oil because it's in rocks of very low permeability. So that's why it's necessary to use horizontal drilling, fracking, chemicals, tons of water, and so on to get the oil out. But the industry's been very successful in terms of production. So by 2015, the U.S. was producing an additional 5 million barrels a day of this stuff. And that has kept world oil prices fairly moderate in the decade since then. I mean, they've gone up and down for a couple of years. They were up around $100 a barrel, then they tanked to lower than $50, and right now they're again around $50 to $60 a barrel, which, you know, historically is kind of high, but it's not at economy killing levels. And meanwhile, the economy has been bailed out by massive amounts of debt. During the last 10 years, of course, we saw central banks working together to keep interest rates low. And also, we had the governments of many countries deficit spending to an enormous degree. The U.S. Has been doing that to such an extent that interest on government debt is now rivaling the rate of spending on the military. So these two things together, the fracking boom and the explosion of debt and low interest debt, have kept the economy from doing what a lot of us were anticipating that it would do back in 2008, which was to tip over into a more or less permanent depression. And so we've had, that's the reason for the title of that article, Our Bonus Decade. It's been a decade of recovery, but that recovery has come at an extraordinary cost. And it's a cost that many of us, I think, are maybe not even aware of.
Yes, you call it a deceptive, uneven, and unsettling, quote-unquote, recovery.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason for that is that by injecting so much money into the financial system, central banks and governments, as a side effect, created a lot of economic inequality. The economy was already very unequal, but the trillions of dollars of quantitative easing and low interest debt that went into saving us from the financial crisis, almost all of that went into the financial industry. And so people in high income households benefited far, far more from the recovery than people in low income households. So the increased economic inequality has then fed into, you know, general dissatisfaction with the current state of affairs. And then that was in turn exacerbated by the growth in social media, which in turn propelled the presidency of Donald Trump, joining fellow authoritarians in Russia, China, Philippines, Hungary, Poland, and elsewhere around the globe. So globally, our political systems have been destabilized to a degree that we haven't seen in decades. And all of this is connected. The growth of the fracking industry, the growth of social media, right-wing populism, and economic inequality have all been part of this recovery from the global financial crisis.
Yes, let me summarize what you write in the bonus decade here. It's a little long, but I think it's worth reading. So you say, let's step back. One, we peak oil analysts had assumed that energy resource depletion would be the immediate trigger for societal collapse. Right. That was something that maybe 7-8 years ago on this show, we had talked about how once the easy oil in Saudi Arabia dries up, we're going to be in trouble. But it was kind of saved by this tight oil. Right.
Right. We were essentially wrong.
Not saved, but
the global oil industry was essentially saved by tight oil. Yeah.
Right. And then your second bullet point, you say, however, climate change is turning out to be a far greater threat than we depletionists had thought 15 or 20 years ago when the peak oil discussion was just getting underway. The impacts of warming atmosphere and oceans are appearing at a frightening and furious pace, and climate feedbacks could make future warming nonlinear and perhaps even unsurvivable. So this was something that it was the kind of the purview of climate change alarmists 10 years ago that, you know, you had to be kind of a kooky Al Gore follower to think that this actually was going to be affecting people in our generation. But we're seeing that that's happening now. And then the third bullet point, you say 10 years ago, we learned that debt cycles and debt bubbles are a significant related factor potentially leading to or hastening civilizational collapse. And then last you say, now we are all getting a rapid education in the ways inequality can lead to political polarization and social instability. So we're kind of seeing a confluence of these factors. If you, remove the peak oil element and replace that with the very capital intensive tight oil, that's kind of allayed the peak oil alarmists. Right. But we have maybe something that's perhaps worse, because it all leads to this never-ending thirst for growth from governments. You see, China's debts have quadrupled during the decade. That was not something we dreamed of in the 90s, for example.
Yeah, and if you look at the tight oil industry, the companies that are specializing in fracking and producing this stuff, and for the most part, they're not the giant oil companies that we think of right off the bat, ExxonMobil, Shell, and so on. Those companies that specialize in tight oil are, for the most part, losing money. In other words, their free cash flow is negative. And that's been true in every year since the beginning of the boom. And you ask yourself, how can that be? You know, how can they be still in business? And the answer is, it's been a result of very low interest rates. They've been able to borrow enormous amounts of money, both for operations and also to pay dividends to shareholders. And then they've been able to attract a lot of money from Wall Street. There's been a lot of money, investment capital floating around as a result of quantitative easing, looking for the next big thing. And the frackers have been able to say, look at all the oil and natural gas we're producing. This is the next big thing. You'd better invest in us. And so some day of reckoning is coming for the fracking industry. Nobody knows exactly when that's going to happen. But at some point, the investors are going to look at the balance sheet and go, you know, it's we can't do this anymore.
Yesterday, refrain of your life, something simple to salt away. And now you've gone and busted your toy. Think once you've managed, you'll soon destroy and take it out on.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. So, Richard, we're talking about the last decade. And yes, the peak oil analysts were wrong in terms of peak oil didn't happen just yet. But one thing that a lot of the fossil fuel advocates were touting a decade ago was that there's just no way for renewables to compete with fossil fuel. And we've seen an expansion in renewable industries across the spectrum. And we're starting to see renewables compete for the first time on a large scale basis with fossil fuels. That's pretty right. Exciting.
Yeah. It's true that in many cases, renewables are now the lowest cost alternative for new power production. That doesn't mean we don't have a big challenge ahead of us, because solar and wind are still, you know, if in terms of our total world energy consumption or usage, solar and wind still are, you know, single digit, probably in the range of 2-3% of total world energy. So to get that up to, you know, anything over 50%, we're talking about an enormous shift. And it's not just a matter of building more solar panels and wind turbines. It also means the electrification of a lot of industry in transportation and manufacturing, in agriculture, and so on. Because, you know, only 20% of our energy usage is in the form of electricity. 80% is in the forms of, you know, solid, liquid, and gaseous fuels. So it's not just a matter of building more, as I say, building more solar panels and wind turbines. We have to retool the entire industrial infrastructure so that we're using electricity. And that's a big job, and it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen simply by markets forcing the transition. It's going to require some, you know, coordinated effort. And who's going to do that coordination? Well, it's hard to imagine it happening without some kind of government support.
Speaking of the transition, you finish your bonus decade Muse letter with this. Let me read the whole thing because I think it's a great way to finish up our discussion. Really, the most difficult aspect of this shift is the initial decision to make it. And once that decision has been made, plenty of improvements to daily life would likely accompany any sacrifices we'd have to make. For example, imagine how a more mindful economy would allow people to pursue their callings instead of just chasing jobs. Or consider how leading less busy lives would allow more time to spend with loved ones. We could put health and happiness on an upward trajectory rather than consumption of throwaway consumer goods. Rather than sharing the distractions now capturing the attention of other drivers, we must each retrain ourselves to pay attention to the instrument panel and the road ahead of us. Abandoning old habits and making new ones requires effort, but some habits are so unwise that changing them is a life or death affair.
Yeah, that's from my essay, A Society of Distracted Drivers.
Well, it's a great parable because that is the most immediate thing a lot of us can do is make decisions about our transportation right there.
Yeah, yeah. And pay attention to what really matters, you know, because my argument in that essay is that we're all basically acting like distracted drivers, you know, looking at our cell phones instead of looking at the road ahead. The important thing is, you know, the survival of our species. You know, if the survival of the biosphere and of humanity are imperiled, while we're, you know, paying attention to political rivalries and the latest gadgets and what's going on in sports and entertainment, we're missing, you know, it's like distracted driving and, you know, paying attention to your cell phone while you run into the truck ahead of you. So yeah, we got to put first things first here.
Well, it's an important reminder for everybody as they start to think about what kind of New Year's resolutions they want to make and look ahead. The end of the year is always kind of a good time for us to look inside ourselves and think what we can do to make a difference. Richard Heinberg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's always a pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Charles Erland and Taj Mahal. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.